You were listening to the Never Meet Your Heroes podcast, conversations with artists about their work and inspiration. I am your host, Anthony Moses Sanchez. All right, thanks for being on our podcast today. I have today Felix Deon, and he's here with us from Mexico City on Skype. Thank you for being with me and meeting with me today.
Thank you. Al contrario.
It's really exciting to have you on the podcast because some of my friends that are artists here in the Pomona, LA area and are already fans of your stuff. And I know one of my friends, Trevor, who was on one of my episodes and was kind of my mentor, has already met you in Mexico City once. So it's one of those, like, I'm going to be interviewing Felix. And I know my friend Raul said he wants your life. So, and I'm sure
that's kind of amazing.
Yeah. So, you've been covered pretty much on, different articles throughout the years. I did a little research before I spoke with you. So I don't want to get into like the basic stuff. But we definitely at least initially want to have you introduce yourself as far as, a little bit of what I've seen so far is that you consider yourself Mexican American. You grew up in Guadalajara.
I grew up in LA, but I'm from Guadalajara.
You're from Guadalajara, and then you came to America. You lived in the Palisades. You were in San Francisco, New York, Milan, Tennessee, and Buenos Aires. So why don't you quickly catch people up with some of your, you know, how you ended up in Mexico City being this fabulous queer man that everybody yearns to be.
Well, I was in San Francisco for a really long time. It was kind of like my base. I went there for college, and then I would go to other places to live for a while. Then I would come back to San Francisco, and then about 5 years ago, it just became too expensive to live in San Francisco, especially as an artist who lives on the sale of my own work. Mm-hmm. And I'd already been traveling a lot to Mexico City. My family's from Guadalajara, so I would go visit there, and then I would go to Mexico City. And ultimately, I just decided that the U.S. was just too expensive.
Okay.
And also, I'm proud of my roots. I love Mexico. I'm, I was excited to come back here. So it's like, so Mexico has been my home base since about 5 years ago.
Okay. Well, what about Mexico City has been great for your art so far?
Well, a big part of it is financial. It's much cheaper here.
Okay.
And so I've been able to live here and support myself as an artist and have hire assistants and live in a great part of town. And so that part of it has been really great. And it's also just a really international city. So there's major museums. There's lots of artists around me. There's a lot to inspire me as an artist. So, okay. It's just I just love Mexico City. So, it's a very liberal city. It's I don't feel like it's any different than San Francisco in that regard.
All right.
Yeah, in fact, sometimes it feels even more liberal to the extent that public displays of affection are more accepted in Mexican culture than they are in the U.S. So you see gay people making out on the metro and things you see more display public displays of gayness than you do even in San Francisco.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I think is my history right that gay marriage was allowed in the city or before even America was or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I know that we don't need to get into how the rest of the country goes, but I know that's, outside of Mexico City, sometimes people have issues with coming out or queer expression.
It's much less liberal.
Yeah, much less liberal. Yeah. I like the way that goes.
I'm always confused by the situation elsewhere because it's the same as when I lived in San Francisco. If I would leave my little bubble of California liberalness, I was sometimes a little nervous and oh no, I'm in the Midwest or something, something like that.
Yeah.
And I would discover that it wasn't as crazy as I thought it was. It's just I had my California prejudices. And I feel the same about being in Mexico City. I just went to visit the town that my family's from, Cocula, which is about an hour from Guadalajara. Uh-huh. And I discovered that there was a gay couple living there openly, which surprised me, So it's just, I don't know, there's just things that, it's more accepting in general, I feel than I had thought. Okay. Although I'm sure that there's also problems that I don't, I don't know. I can't speak to it because I haven't personally experienced it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not going to be responsible for, you're not here to report everybody's experience in Mexico City.
Yeah.
One of the things that churned up in my research was, that you have a twin?
Yes. Marcelito.
Okay. So I thought that was interesting, but he's not part of any of your, I should back up and make sure people that are listening and aren't familiar with your work, the style of your work typically is kind of nostalgic etchings in a kind of Edwardian, Victorian, and sometimes Art Nouveau style, that kind of like a revision of gay history of images from that. Am I describing that right for you?
Yeah, no, that's good. Okay. That's a good.
It probably, as you began, it was probably a much smaller scope, but as time has gone on, you've explored other subjects.
Yes, other styles and also other subject matter. Initially, it was more just like Latino and white gay men, and then as time passed, you know, like now I paint lesbians and transgender people and like a much broader variety of people than I used to, like a broader spectrum of the queer community.
Yeah. I mean, you have to forgive me when I fanboy, because I do definitely, one of the exciting things about some of the artwork that you do and how it gets, it exposes me to other sexualities. I've worked with Tom of Finland Foundation and been around a lot of erotica for a couple of years. So, you know, it's really great when something surprises you and excites you and, you know, makes you a little hot and you don't realize like, hey, wow, like, look at that, you know, that's two lesbians or that's transgender people. So that's really exciting to see that, and that you're explored, you know, the whole spectrum. I know it came up, but maybe to tell quickly some of the listeners that aren't familiar, I feel like I'm answering a lot of things for you. But, you know, your earlier influences with this style was through your mom?
Yes. As a kid, my mom used to take us to a lot of museums and things like that in the LA area, like the Huntington Library and things like that. So I was exposed young to very, like, conservative kinds of artworks, like Rococo and 19th century art that I used to love and which I still love. Mm-hmm. And also we had a lot of children's books that were really beautiful that were antique, you know, like Victorian, Edwardian, mid-century type books. And I think that my current love for these styles definitely came from my childhood exposure to them, you know. Mm-hmm. And also from the fact that when I would see these kinds of books, they were pretty much always like white people and straight people. And so as an adult, it's been nice to insert, you know, like queer people into those narratives.
Right. One thing that's interesting for me when I look at your work, though, is, you know, I'm someone who's studied literature, and there definitely was a period with like Oscar Wilde, like people that were creating, you know, queer art or what would be seen as now as queer art, but visually it didn't exist. So in writing, as someone who's read some of these books, like even, you know, Picture of Dorian Gray, who's kind of obviously coded as like a gay novel.
Yeah.
If you read it and you visualize it, so in my head, when I look at the pictures, they kind of feel very like, where have these been all these centuries? Which I think is what's exciting about it. And were you seeing similar things? Is that what, as you're saying, you know, you only saw the white people, you only saw.
Yeah. Well, it's like, I mean, they're like, even like the examples that you suggested, like Dorian Gray, who's coded gay, it's like, it's coded gay. It's not explicitly gay. You know,
right.
It's like, we know that he was gay, you know, like that. Oscar Wilde is gay, and we know that, you know, or like, In Search of Lost Time by Proust, it's like just Albertine is clearly a gay man, but you know, written as a woman.
Right.
And like, I think that it's really, you know, like when I read those books, it's like I'm reading that queer context into it.
Right.
But it's really nice to live today where I can. It's not a queer context; it's explicitly queer or of color, you know, like of minorities. And and that's something that I felt like wasn't there, that even if the artist wanted it to be there, couldn't actually put it there. And that now it's like we have all of this freedom to do so. And since we have the freedom, we should definitely take advantage of it.
Right. Especially because, well, again, someone who's kind of, I've looked at a lot of gay history, there's definitely cycles of when gay expression is kind of blossoms and then kind of there's always a conservative backlash that kind of suppresses it. So it does feel like, I feel like for gay artists, until that freedom exists permanently, there definitely is a, like, you definitely have to be aware of, like, you need to produce, because you don't know when the next book burning is going to happen. And it's sad, but it's a possibility. I love that you're prolific so far. And how long have you been working on this particular sets of work?
About 7 or 8 years, maybe, is when I started using like the kind of artwork that looks like what I do now.
Mm-hmm.
Not very long.
Okay, you have a lot of artwork that's for sale online on Etsy and eBay. You mentioned that you have the freedom, and that freedom is the internet, that you have direct access to consumers and art lovers.
Yes.
Do you think that if without that technology, you would, how do you think you would have navigated that? It's hard to imagine, but
it's really hard to imagine. It's like, I think that I would be a gallery artist. I do show in galleries every now and then, but it's like being able to just be my own, you know, like Instagram, you know, is basically like a marketing tool that lets people know that I exist. And then, and like the more followers I have on Instagram, the more artwork I sell on Etsy, which allows me to keep on making more artwork. And, you know, so it's like social media and modern technology definitely has allowed my ability to be an artist to flourish mm-hmm. in a way galleries don't. Galleries are limiting. They're very limiting.
Right. Yeah. I think so far with the people that are my friends or people that I've talked to on the podcast already, that, you know, the studio art, you know, it's like a waiting game and it's a networking thing and yeah. you have direct access is something that's, I think, exciting about why us as the public get to see so much of your work so frequently.
Yeah.
Is there any advice you'd give to anybody that wants to kind of get into their queer art or even just, you know, any kind of artwork and getting it on Etsy and eBay? Any advice to anyone that's listening and kind of gets inspired by you?
I think that it just requires a lot of discipline in terms of like of regularly producing artwork, making sure that it's like the social media is a total key to it. It's if I didn't have as many followers as I have on Instagram and that kind of thing, I wouldn't be able to make the living that I do. So it's like posting things online every single day and like being a relentless self-promoter.
Right.
So it's like those things definitely help because without doing that, I wouldn't be able to make a living. All I do all day long, every single day is paint. Like I have no other job. That is my job.
Right.
And it's really great. And I feel like if I have advice, like, or if I feel like when I see people who, for whom it hasn't worked out, I feel like in part it's because they don't keep it up long enough. Because it takes a little bit of time to get an audience and to make it work as a business, and it requires, you know, and like some of that time it just feels like nothing is happening because you're, you know, it's slow initially. But I think if you just keep at it and you're good, that, you know, that it'll happen.
Right. Well, I guess I'll mention as well that. That it's fun to also see you on Snapchat. I think we get the more uncensored version on Snapchat.
Yes, the very uncensored.
And that's mostly where I see. But then I'm a thirsty hoe, so I know where to look for all this stuff. sorry, Mom. So I think that's really fun to kind of experience that.
I have a very colorful one, so it's easy to there's a lot there.
There definitely is. Let's get into some of your stronger influences that are really obvious to at least me. I'm kind of similar to your story in that my grandma took me to LACMA a lot. So that was kind of our regular outings. So LACMA is where I saw a lot of artwork. And the stuff that like George Barbier and Hokusai, which is his famous work, is the blue, that wave. You know, those are the two obvious things that you synthesized. You know, they keep coming back as far as the etching styles. Better question might be, how are you processing the work? You have your models first,
yeah,
right? Yeah. Do you kind of have an idea beforehand what you're doing as far as the models? So,
usually I have an idea for the model before the model gets here.
Okay.
And take maybe two or three photos of a particular painting that I want to make. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so like for those ones, it's like I might semi-dress the model or dress them all together or, you know, like have props and like everything because I know exactly what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And then I'll usually like take a lot of photos of them, you know, like especially if I have couples, like just kissing and being romantic and, you know, pretending to engage, to propose to one another, all kinds of just whatever things, you know, mm-hmm. like, which then I have a massive database of thousands upon thousands upon thousands of photos. So when I'm painting, it's like I'll do the paintings that I planned from initially, but then I'll also make paintings where I didn't plan it, but I just have a couple that are kissing and I think it's a really great photo and they look beautiful. And then I'll invent something around that. So like once I have the photo, then I usually trace the figures. Mm-hmm. I could draw the, but there's no reason because it just takes more time, you know?
Right.
So, and then I usually invent the clothing. They're usually nude when I take the picture, and then I invent whatever they're wearing on top.
Right.
Along with the clothing. And then at that point is usually when I'll be paying attention to different styles. So it's like, because like one of the things that I do a lot is I collect antique music sheets,
mm-hmm.
and I cut out the original picture and use the frame, the antique frame. So then based on the frame, it'll determine the style of the picture. So if it's like an Art Nouveau frame, then when I'm making the painting, I'll be looking at Art Nouveau pictures of like how do they draw flowers and how do they draw clothes and what mm-hmm. kind of clothes are appropriate to an Art Nouveau painting. And, you know, so then I do a bunch of research and like, and so the paintings kind of come together that way.
Okay. Well, I want to bring one example up that you did recently, Tattoo Lovers, that I know, again, because I follow you on definitely on Snapchat, and then sometimes I see stuff on Instagram.
Yeah.
And I know that image, if people are looking at it and they haven't seen the behind-the-scenes stuff, and they could probably find it if they scroll back through your Instagram stuff. That's a good example of, like, that you would think that that image is exactly verbatim, if you will, and that you kind of – you know, created something else from those models.
Well, the models were actually me and a friend of mine.
Right.
And and so then, and you know, since I mean, I'm Latino, but I look white. and the other model is like Mexican and like is he's what people tend to think a Mexican looks like. You know, I don't know.
Okay.
And, so then, since in that particular case, I decided to be faithful to what we look like. Uh-huh. So I painted him with. I made him look kind of cholo, you know, with like tattoos and like a headband and things like that. And then I gave myself like old fashioned like sailor type tattoos and like but it's like the picture was just like two nude people, neither of whom have tattoos. The original photo,
right?
And then from that, I felt like I wanted to make this sort of interracial image that was going to play with these tattoos and like the kind of loving pose between us.
Yeah,
I still really like taking really masculine imagery, like of cholos and things like that, and like making them and gay and, you know, like, and queering them. So right. I don't know where that thing have come from. Yeah.
Yeah. My two favorites, I made notes here in case I wanted to bring them up, was the Amor Nouveau and Amor Picante. Those were like two. So those are two examples, like, especially Amor Picante, which is, a big kind of oso style Mexican on top of a big chile. And like,
it was actually. Friend, that guy
was he?
And actually, Amor Nouveau was the same guy, but with me. It's like I painted it as a present for him.
Okay,
like, it's the same model.
Excellent. That's always fun. But yeah, it's great to see these things. And I remember I showed my friend the Amor Picante, and she was like, "That's so gay and so Mexican," which I'm sure is what you were going for. I mean, it hit all the buttons. So one thing that I thought it was interesting that when I was digging up your past was, because we're talking about the nude models, and sometimes you model nude as well for some of these images. Is part of do you identify as like a nudist, or is it just free love, or how would you describe that part of your life?
So I wouldn't identify as a nudist, but clearly I am. I think I'm more of a sensualist. Okay. I don't know. I have these parties where I strip everybody naked and dress them in jewels. And I live with a couple of handsome boys and my boyfriend. And like, basically we only wear clothes occasionally and
right.
It's nice and warm in Mexico. And so it's just, I don't know. Like, I love the body. I love I'm super sex positive. I'm, you know, and it just seems like it's a more enjoyable way to live life to embrace the body and to embrace nudity and sensuality and you know, that kind of beauty than to not. And why wouldn't you if you can?
Right. I mean, I'm definitely, I have been invited to plenty of parties in the same vein, but I think when it's consenting and all adults agree and our understanding of the situation, it can be a beautiful and fun experience. And it isn't always sexual, which I think is, I actually... was at a nudist beach. Well, I've gone to the nudist beach here in San Diego, Black's Beach, which I don't think exists anymore. And I've been to the one in Maui called Little Beach.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And you always either have the onlookers who are just think it's silly, or you have the people that are just kind of like finally I can just be myself. So,
yes, it's true.
So outside looking in, that's what's fun about watching your little soirees that you have.
Well, they're fun to. It's like fun to be in, and it's fun to share as well. So you know.
I mean, I think it fits with the style of your artwork, though. I think that like that's the one fun thing about your artwork is you kind of walk the walk, talk the talk.
Yes.
You know, the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties was definitely that time of period, and
yes,
and even to connect again with the idea that your revisionist artwork, that there were that was a time in the 20s before the Pansy Scare, where you know where I'm forgetting her name, Mae West. So Mae West. Mae West was one of the people who kind of caused the Pansy Scare, not necessarily caused it, but she had a lot of gay men around her for obvious reasons. And so, you know, there was a time, people that don't know, you know, when we're saying that you're reclaiming history, in some ways you're kind of bridging the gap between what actually was already happening, and your parties kind of reflect that.
Yeah. Although the thing that's beautiful about today is, like, in the past, it's like in the 20s, for example, like Berlin, you know, like there were places that were famously open and tolerant and things like that. But even then, it was still within a very small, the bubble of acceptance was very small. It's like, you know, since basically ancient Rome, right. It's like acceptance has been small. And it's like kind of incredible to live in a time where there's been a sea change, where it's like, it's not just like that there's little bubbles, like say Mexico City or San Francisco, where it's accepted, but like now, more than, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but it's like over 50% of Americans support gay marriage, for example.
Right.
Which is incredible. You know, so it's like the fact that there is gay marriage and like all, you know, and that was not even a dream in the 20s. Like people couldn't even imagine that. Like it wasn't even like a thought for the future. Whereas now it's a reality in like an increasingly large part of the world. And it's pretty incredible to live in this moment when that's the case, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, all we have is, you know, the written records and sometimes some little, like, you know, picture, like little films that might have been made. But definitely it was a time where you had these little parties where you can be yourself. But then probably when you went home, you had to go back and put your suit and tie and hat on. And, you know,
and even in some of these places, those parties were illegal. It's like not like, you know, like New York, for example, it's like, you know, there was certainly tolerant areas there as well. But like ultimately... like I made a painting called the Wedding of Gladys Bentley, who was a jazz singer from a blues singer, actually from the Harlem Renaissance. And she married a woman and she had like a public wedding where she married this woman in the '20s. And you know, so there was a moment where that was somewhat acceptable, but even then it's like, there were still raids at gay bars.
Right.
And ultimately when she died, she had converted to Christianity and she had renounced her old gay way of life. And, you know, cause she'd like, you know, after the '20s, like even those little windows are closed, but it's just, I don't know. It's like, we live in an extraordinary time, which is, it's kind of interesting that, you know,
right.
That's the case. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you think about, you know, as at least here in America, we're dealing with this neo-Nazi thing coming up again. And you think again, what we're talking about the 1920s and Berlin and the cabarets and the queer culture that existed there. And it's been brought up on the TV series Transparent as well. You know, just so visually people, you know, that aren't familiar with it. But yeah, it's like right now with the internet, we're so connected and it's just wonderful. I mean, even right now I'm talking to you, you're in Mexico City. So yeah. And one other influence that, well, so there was a couple of artists that have come up when people ask you, you know, who are you, you know, currently or more contemporary influenced by? And one is Kara Walker, who she comes up a lot for a lot of people. What about her specifically? Do you feel like you relate to her?
Well, like when I was in college, I kind of discovered her and that I loved her. It's like, I guess as a gay Mexican American in college, like, you know, she's a African American artist and speaks to the Black experience, but I felt like, and she's also speaking about a specific experience within that, which is usually has to do with slavery.
Right.
Nonetheless, in a larger way, I felt like she has a really great technique in terms of like a classical technique, and she uses it to critique the culture that we're living in a way that's really profound, in a very modern and contemporary way. And so from very early on, I was really in love with her because I felt like she was a way for me to imagine how I could use my own technique to say something that's relevant to like contemporary culture. You know, I mean, that's just in my own personal, how can I use this thing that I'm looking at way, you know, like I also just think she's an incredible artist. Yeah.
Yeah. And then another one that comes up frequently that you bring up is Felix Gonzalez Torres, who is a Cuban and lived through that. He's one of those artists who lived through that AIDS era and like art was just had to be kind of like, There's just some artists that just like that. Larry Kramer also wrote about that period, and it was a very specific energy. What about his stuff relates to yours? Because Felix's stuff is a little bit more art gallery style.
Well, my work is much more conservative.
Right.
it's like more traditional, you know. Uh-huh. I paint and draw, and he does like installation and performance art and things like that. I don't know how much influence he's actually had on my work. I just love him as an artist.
Okay.
I think that he's somebody that whenever I come across his work in a gallery, I feel really, you know, moved by it. I think he's really incredible, or he was really incredible. But yeah, as far as like the influence on my own day to day life and work, it's like it's not something that I think about so much. Mm-hmm. It's just that I love him, which is why I brought him up in a couple of different interviews.
Okay, well, that's good to clarify that. One thing I wanted to maybe back up a bit on is there's a little bit of a story that, like, in your youth when you came to Mexico City, like about 16, that's kind of, you know, you did figure drawing stuff or modeling.
So, yes.
Would you be willing to expound on what that experience was like?
That used to be my job.
Okay.
Like, I used to be an artist model.
Okay.
So, like, that was actually like also the last thing I did before my work started selling and I could just be an artist, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, it depended on, in San Francisco, I could work at, there were like three or four different art schools mm-hmm. and a lot of artists. So it was possible to just do that as a full-time job. And then because I've lived a kind of a bohemian life of travel all over the place,
mm-hmm.
it was also something that I could do when I would arrive at different places and like go online or go to the local art school and just like figure out, like, it was an easy way to get like under the table work.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That could help fund my roving lifestyle of irresponsible, like, you know, traveling pleasure.
Right.
So, and it was also fun. It was like of all the jobs I've had a lot of jobs.
Yeah.
And it was one of the ones that I enjoyed the most. Like, because I felt like I was good at, I haven't done it in years now,
uh-huh.
but like I was good at it. Like, it was fun to watch the look at the artwork that the students were making. It got me in all kinds of like strange situations in terms of like artists and, you know, I don't know, some of which were just unusual.
Of course.
So, like,
right.
You know, I don't know. It was a fun way to make money.
But did you feel like, I guess there's an assumption maybe if someone looks at that, myself included, that like that's how you got into the, you know, this, the sensual artwork that you do.
No, I don't think so. I think that's just me.
Okay.
Like, actually, it's like me winding up an artist model is more an expression of like
uh-huh.
that kind of sensuality and exhibitionism that I have anyway, you know?
Right.
So it's like, I started doing figure drawing workshops and things like that in high school. So it's like it's exposed from really young to that as a possibility. And also I knew I wanted to be an artist when I grew up. And so I would paint other students in my high school, and I would paint I was already doing this from really young. And it's part inspired by the books I was reading, because I would go to the library and check out books about Michelangelo and Degas and, like, you know, all of these like art stars of history, and like basically that's what everybody did. So I was like, well, I need to do this too. And then because I was already doing that, then I got, you know, packed off to junior college so that I could take figure drawing classes, not just figure drawing classes, art classes, but being drawing classes. And you know, and so like since I was already in that environment and seeing what was going on and what these possibilities were, then it just made sense that when I would, like, you know, run away from home, leave my like wild life, that I would, like, you know, do that as a way to make money, because it was already in my head as a possibility.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Michelangelo has probably influenced a lot of people, especially with the nude figures that he's done.
They're so gay.
They're so gay. They're so beautiful. It doesn't even. I feel like it's hard when you're a gay man. You obviously enjoy the male figure. So, but I feel like anyone that goes, you know, is uncertain, they could see, you know, a Michelangelo painting or David is a very obvious, statue where you're like, wow, like, aren't humans beautiful?
Yes.
Not to be too cisgendered, you know, they're all beautiful, but he definitely has some very beautiful work there. So why don't we catch up on some you know, how are things been there in Mexico City since the earthquake? How long has it been now? Like 2 months now since the earthquake?
Something like that, yeah. It basically feels like it didn't happen already.
Okay. Well, with all the – at least like, here in America with all the news, it's hard.
It was – I definitely felt like it happened when it happened. I was like freaking the hell out. Like I thought my – you know, it was like – it was terrifying. It was like I and everybody I knew thought they were going to die.
Oh, but, okay.
Yeah, it was super terrifying. I completely freaked out. There were cracks in the walls of my house because whole building tilted backwards and was crashing against the building behind us.
Wow.
There were like little teeny cracks. And an engineer came. I thought they were long but narrow.
Okay.
And an engineer came and said that my house is fine and there's nothing to worry about. But when the cracks appeared, that's not what I was thinking. I was thinking, oh, my house is going to fall down any second. And I don't know, like – it was really intense. But if you walk in for five blocks in almost any direction, something fell down. But you can also like walk for, you know, like you have to kind of like, if you choose your path carefully, you can like, you know, not even realize that anything had ever happened. You know, it's like, it's a huge city and, you know, a lot of buildings did fall down and a lot were condemned. And, you know, I have friends, I have at least one friend who lost his building collapsed.
Wow.
But now it's been, you know, a couple of months out and, people have, you know, found new places to live and, you know, I don't know, it's like cleaned up and moved on and like, and prices have gone up.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
I thought for sure they were going to go down, but they didn't, they went up. So,
yeah, I mean, I guess it's something to talk about for people that live in the, you know, here in the Pacific, in that Ring of Fire area where the tectonics, change so much, you know, like I've lived through the Whittier Narrows earthquake and the Northridge earthquake, and there hasn't really been a big earthquake here in LA yet. And I know people that haven't been through an earthquake. It's horrifying the first time.
Yeah.
How many have you? There was several recently in Mexico, though. There was the one that we just spoke of.
Well, there have been a bunch in Mexico that have been big enough to scare people, and like, you know, everybody runs out. But this is the first one. Like, I was in the Northridge quake, you know, but I was really young. I don't remember it well, other than that it was scary. But like, this is the first time I've been in a city when a natural disaster happened.
Okay.
And it was pretty amazing. It's like everybody was, you know, like there were so many people at the volunteer station, you know, like the centros de acopio, like I don't know what you say that in English, like the centers for helping people. They would open these stations where you would go and get helped.
Okay.
And so many people would go there to get to volunteer that there was like, you know, you had to wait for like 2 hours just to like help.
Oh, that's beautiful.
You know, like people were like, you know, rescuing stray dogs that had been lost and like bringing people into their homes and
cleaning
stuff. And like there were piles and piles and piles of stuff that people had donated. And, you know, it was pretty beautiful to see how everybody came together and helped each other out. And, you know, it was quite inspiring. And it was, you know, also really terrifying because, you know, they were digging people out for quite a while afterwards. And, you know, just in my normal day-to-day life of wandering around, it would be like, oh my God, that building's gone too. And, you know, like that kind of experience.
Yeah.
My neighborhood was kind of the worst hit. Mm-hmm. The neighborhood next to mine was much worse. Like when I went to Condesa and went for a walk over there and not really realizing it. And like there's a street where basically every third house had fallen down. So I don't know. It was intense. But I don't know. Life moves on. So.
Yeah, it sounds like things are pretty organized there. I've seen documentaries about Japan that has a similar system where, because they get a lot of earthquakes and like the whole neighborhoods, there's systems to like take care of elderly people and getting them prescriptions and
I don't know if it's like, I've heard stories afterwards about the way people were being dug out of the buildings that was not the right way. And, you know, like some of the people who volunteered were saying how they were getting, like the same things were being moved from center to center without like, it just, I don't know, like the I'm skeptical of the government here. I think the people came out were really doing their 110%, but you know, they're not professionals, and so like not everything was done the way it should have been done.
Maybe to move a little bit towards politics, I do want to go back to, I've read that you identify as Chicano, and you know, even here in LA, you know, my family's been, you know, in the United States since at least before the Great Depression. So we definitely, as a family, you know, we don't know Spanish, but we still have a very kindred spirit with Mexicans, because our culture, we keep getting immigrants here. And that's, you know, in the 70s when the Chicano movement happened, there was definitely this sense of like, you know, if I went to Mexico now, I would be identified as an American. And so I'm curious with you, you've lived between the two borders. How do you define what it means to be Mexican American or Chicano?
Well, that's so difficult. And also and partly because I'm very white looking. Mm-hmm. I'm like really, I have blue eyes and blonde hair. It's like, so in the US, like I definitely didn't feel like a normal white person mm-hmm. because I was raised in a Mexican household. I learned English as a second language. Mm-hmm. Like my culture was very much not like a mainstream white culture.
Right.
So I felt like the white students in the school around me were not like me. They were different than me. I was like the Mexican students or the Chicano mm-hmm. students.
Right.
Also like white people have had a tendency to say crazy things about Mexicans in front of me my whole life because they just assume I'm white.
Did we live the same life?
It's weird.
Yeah.
But then Latinos in the US had a tendency to treat me weird too because right. I'm so white. So it's like, when I used to self-identify as Chicano in the U.S., like sometimes people would be weird to me about that. Like, oh, happy Chicano because you have blue eyes. You know, it's like, I remember as a kid going to a Mecha meeting mm-hmm. To get a scholarship to go to college. And so I was like sitting there, like, it was like a political rally. And he was talking about La Raza de Bronce and like this whole like, you know, brown power kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not brown at all. And so like, I remember feeling, the longer I sat there listening to it, I wanted to sink into my seat and disappear because it was like people were looking at me like, what is this white boy doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it was a lot about like white brown power and like right. the white people land and like this whole kind of thing, which I totally get all of that. It's just like my presence there is just strange. And so I'm treated in this rather strange way. And ultimately, I actually did get that scholarship and I went to university on a Latino scholarship.
Uh-huh.
But like my feelings about what I am were always very confused in the U.S. Ultimately, I came to the decision that I'm Chicano with white privilege.
Okay.
but then I moved to Mexico, and it kind of clarified everything because in Mexico, I realized I'm just American.
Okay. Yeah.
It's I mean, my relationship to Mexico is also funny because within Mexico, sometimes people, when I make really Mexican artwork, people will say to me things like, "Oh, it's so interesting that a foreigner is that interested." culture, and I'll be like, well,
yeah,
I'm not that much of a foreigner, you know.
Yeah.
It's I don't know, I'm in a particularly confusing situation because of, you know, my skin color, where I'm from, like all of these kinds of things, but like ultimately I feel like it's a really privileged position to be coming from, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like being a Chicano in the U.S. is great. It's like I feel like it gives the perspective of looking at American culture from an outsider's point of view a mm-hmm. little bit. It's like you're from there, but you're also treated as if you're not in some way. And
right.
you can see the culture and the way mainstream culture works with a more dispassionate view, I feel like, you know?
Right.
So it means a little bit that you feel like you're always outside of it, you know?
Yeah.
But like that very place means that as an artist, you have there's a lot to say. You have a lot of observations to make because mm-hmm. of where you're placed in it. And myself as like a gay person, you know, like mixed race, like this whole background that I have, it's like, I feel like it's given me a really rich perspective of the world that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it makes sense.
No, it does. I guess at this point I'm just relating to you because I, you know, I've grown up, I've had some experiences where people will make racist jokes to me and I'm kind of in between. People will believe I'm Italian if they need to. So they don't.
Yeah.
So they don't need to believe that I'm Mexican. Do you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
I've had situations where they're like, "Oh, you're Mexican American." So,
yeah.
And you know, I love my dark skin, so
yeah.
I don't have a problem with either one. But I do notice when people they to make themselves more comfortable to make racist jokes, they kind of have to move you into a certain place. And then on the other side, when I've been to Spain or when I've been to Argentina, it's
yeah.
the other way where I just cannot bring up that I'm American because there's just so much politics, so many things that America has done to kind of, you know, undermine Spanish speaking countries
yeah.
that they don't realize that I am a similar outsider, connecting back what you said. Like
yeah.
I'm also an outsider. I'm
yeah.
I'm dealing with the same kind of push that they're doing to you guys, except obviously they're doing it to an entire country, whereas, yeah, you know, so yeah, yeah, it's hard to explain that to some people, though, that, you know, they just see, oh, well, you know, you have, you know, several iPods, so therefore you don't understand. But but do you feel like your artwork is kind of on that champion of, you know, you are an outsider, but you want to be able to tell a story?
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel like the artwork that I make is all about giving a voice to marginalized people. So it's mm-hmm. like, you know, even if you're white, if you're gay, you're a minority and you're marginalized, you know? Right. So it's like, and the work that I make is like trying to address as many members of the queer community as possible. Like, you know, ethnicities that aren't Latino or white, you know, like African American, Native American, like Asian, whatever, you know, transgender people. It's like, I feel like I've given a voice to people like myself, you know, which mm-hmm. would be, I don't know, I place myself as both Chicano and white, so it's like right. gay or Latino men, you know, like mm-hmm. I've been doing that for years, and then in the last few years I decided that I wanted to make that broader and include other voices, and that's a little more challenging and tricky, because it's like, if I paint, like that painting that you were talking about, Amor Picante, it's like, mm-hmm. it's me to do, because I am myself Latino, and like, it's hard for, you know, like, I'm not going to make a racist image of, like, a Mexican.
Right.
I am, you know. So, like, I could picture if I was white, like, that some, like, I might be, it might feel funny to make a painting like that, which is playing so much with Mexican stereotypes.
Yeah.
So, like, and that's something that where, when I'm making paintings of other ethnicities that are not Latino.
Yeah.
They're still queer, uh-huh. where it becomes harder, or when I paint transgender people. And that basically, it basically means that I'm like, I don't really like to make paintings unless I talk to somebody who belongs to the group that I'm painting.
Yeah.
So it's like, I make paintings of transgender people. It's like, I didn't really start to do that until I didn't have any friends who were transgender. So I like picked up some of my fans to find like people who were transgender, and I wrote them, and I'm like, you know, could you give me your advice? Mm-hmm. You know, as a transgender person, I was like, I want to make transgender paintings. Like, please tell me like, how you see yourself, what kind of image you want to see, so that I'm painting what they're imagining of themselves rather than what I imagine of them, you know?
Right.
You know, so it's just like it's a process, I feel mm-hmm. like, to make artwork about, you know, like, about people who don't reflect my own experience.
Right. I mean, I think I totally understand that, as far as just wanting to get out of your bubble and also be sensitive to these other communities and add them yeah. to your experience, your life. And it yeah, shows yeah. that, you know, I think that's why when I see, you know, Asian lesbians, I don't feel like it's being done as a reappropriation
yeah.
or even, I think the new word that they're saying is culture vultures, that you're just kind of like, I want that, and I'm going to take that, and I'm going to make it my own. So that does come through.
Although I feel like, in contradistinction to what you just said, it's not even that I want to make it my own, but I want to give it back to the community that I took it from.
Right. Yeah.
Like, when I paint like an image of like lately I've been painting a bunch of images of Filipinos, of gay mm-hmm. Filipinos, and that's entirely based on a particular Filipino friend that I have. And so, like, you know, I talked to him and I was like, you know, what's your experience of being he's a Filipino American, but he's been mm-hmm. to the Philippines. So I was like, you know, what kind of image do you, you know, see as like a gay Filipino? Like, what would you, like, what are your, like, you know, how would I make a painting to reflect your own experience?
Right.
And it is appropriation, because I'm not Filipino, I'm not Asian, I don't okay. have that experience, but at the same time, I'm making it because I think it's hot. Like, when he tells me what he thinks is hot, like his experiences in the Philippines about sex and these particular kinds of like beach bungalow houses that they make and things, I'm like, wow, that sounds really hot. Uh-huh. You know, like, but ultimately I'm also making it for him and for uh-huh. his community and for like gay Filipinos to like, you know, see this kind of a reflection of themselves.
Right. Well, yeah. Okay. I see what you're saying, as far as you're not reappropriating, but you're not misappropriating. You are connected with what they're interested in.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing that I probably we can kind of wrap up into, that's come up, that I definitely relate to with your vision and artwork, is this idea that your art is accessible and that it's democratic in some way. And I feel uh-huh. like that's even more important right now. And if, you know, it fits with what you're saying, as far as you make sure that you're not just taking something, you're part of the community when you, you know, express what they think is sexy. So yeah. how are you still feeling about the price points for some of your artwork is definitely accessible?
Yes. Well, that's like one of the places where I feel like it's such a liberating thing to be an artist today, as opposed to being an artist showing in galleries.
Mm-hmm.
It's like galleries take 50% of everything you make.
Mm-hmm.
So work that you sell with them has to be expensive. There's no way it can't be, because it's like, I need my full amount that I need plus the 50% that they're going to take.
Right.
And they just tend to be expensive spaces. They're like privileged spaces.
Right.
So it's like, I really love being able to, I consider myself a popular artist. It's like, okay. I went to art school and I studied, you know, like these artists that I'm quoting as like my favorite artists, which were like Carol Walker and Felix Gonzalez Torres, are like, you know, they're in that rarefied sphere of like the art elite, you know, where they, the work is like worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more. And I absolutely love what they do, but what they do in general, like I think Felix Gonzalez Torres in particular, unless you have an art education, it's kind of hard to access what he does.
Yeah.
Like it would require kind of going there with an artist or an art historian and someone to mm-hmm. explain to what his work means if you just show up without an art background, you know? And I really like the idea of being able to make artwork that connects to a broad range of people. It's like the reason I do what I do is to make people feel good and to make them feel beautiful. It's like to make them feel accepted, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the way to do that is to make the work accessible, to make it so that it's something that people can approach.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, on the one hand, that means like making artwork that I was already saying things that people can understand, you know?
Right.
And it also, on another level, is like making the work accessible financially so that you can afford to buy it and hang it on your wall, which is also selfishly works out well for me.
Yeah.
It's like, it's, you know, allowing me to afford to support myself and live as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's before this, like I used to, you know, work show exclusively in galleries and the work was really expensive, and I never knew when it was going to sell or it wasn't. And like, you know, Soul Sub thing was really great, but it was just like harder. And now it's like, because the work is so low, it's like it's a regular income that's always coming in. Uh-huh. You know, at least in terms of the prints. You know, like I try to keep everything accessible, but you know,
I mean, some of my friends that do studio art, you know, even if it does go to the gallery, they're kind of limited on how they could even do prints or other kind of things.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very like they just got to – it's like a lottery. They got to wait and hope that sells. Yeah. And it takes hours. It costs a lot to buy the paint.
Yes.
I think it's great. I guess what I relate to is this, you know, right now we see how Frida Kahlo, who's another – you know, great pop icon. She's, I feel like every year exponentially, I see more images of her stuff. And I think that's the power of, you know, even with that period of time with her and Diego Rivera, understanding that art needs to be accessible to the people. And right now with this kind of super capitalism, late stage capitalism that's happening, I feel like that's really important in art. Art educations are very expensive here in America. You know, you can end up in so much debt just getting an MFA. And I feel like part of why your artwork can do what it does is because the other set of people have to work in that system. And it's weird that you kind of get stuck, and it creates art for only the elites then.
Yeah. But I want to defend it too, because it's like, like artists like Felix Gonzalez Torres only work in that context. You know, it's like Kara Walker as well. It's like she makes these enormous pieces that like, you know, cascade across the wall. And I do think that her work is harder to access as well. It's much more confrontational than my work. It comes from this rather negative place, you know, in terms, it's coming from a very, it's a very harsh critique. And it requires those kinds of spaces to make it possible, you know, like, because the opposite of that is that I feel limited in the sense that this isn't something that I want to do anyway, but if I wanted to make, you know, 60-foot long paintings that like covered entire walls with like, you know, monumental figures, and I could do that and imagine I'm going to sell that piece on Etsy.
You know,
it would take like, you know, so long to make it. It would be so exciting. You know, like, I'm not going to put a piece on Etsy to sell for $60,000. You know, that's just not. So like these artists who want to make these pieces that are that ambitious require space, you know, and it's like, I do feel like the audience is somewhat limited. It's like the people who love Felix Gonzalez Torres are like, it's a rarefied group, but it's not like it's that small. There's still like many, 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 many thousands of people. He's a famous artist and he's well loved by a lot of people.
Right.
And this exists to show him, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like that's why I feel like I consider myself more of like a popular artist, where right. where I my goal is a little different, I think, in terms of what I want. It's mm-hmm. like it's a much more specific thing, and for me, like, social media and Etsy and those kinds of ways of presenting is absolutely perfect for what I do. It's like my ambition is fulfilled mm-hmm. by being able to work in those contexts, you know.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't want to like be too down on like the gallery space.
Trying to say like they're you know, they shouldn't exist. I mean, I think the separation is the difference between, like, if you look at film, you have blockbuster films and then you have your indie films, or you have your big pop icons that you know, are always going to, you know, sell millions, and then you got your indie stuff. So I think like that's probably what the art that we're talking about. Like, they're going to both exist, and they both have to exist.
Yeah.
But it's more, you know, obviously art that people can accept, you know, have a piece in their own home is very important. Yeah. And I think it's great that you're able to do that.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a good place for me to end. So thanks very much for being on my podcast. I'll have on the website all the, you know, all the ways that they can find you. Definitely you're on FelixDeon.com is the best way to find you. And then Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Etsy, and eBay are all other great places for people to take a look for you. Anywhere else that anything – I know right now you have some Christmas stuff up for sale, Christmas cards, so people should take a look at that.
Yeah. We're getting all crazy about Christmas at the moment, so there'll be Christmas everything.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again very much for being on my podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Never Meet Your Heroes podcast. Find us at nevermeetyourheroespodcast.com, where you can post comments, ask questions, and interact with artists and listeners. Also, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. And if you're on YouTube, don't forget to comment, like, and subscribe.